Cook to Red Alert Radio. Grassroots radio with an ear on the issues that matter to you.
Tēnā koutou katoa. This is Greg Presland and this is Red Radio. And with me today, I'm very pleased to announce that I have Deborah Russell, MP for Newland, my local MP. Welcome, Deborah.
Kia ora. It's great to be here.
And you've had quite an interesting 3 years, haven't you? You've come from Taranaki up to Auckland and to Parliament. And
yeah, it's been a very full-on 3 years. Actually, it was around about 3 years ago, exactly 3 years ago, that I made the move up to Auckland. It's a great place to live.
And you're proud to be a Westie, aren't you?
I sure am. Actually, well, I grew up in Taranaki on the west coast, and the beaches feel the same. And so that's cool. But one of the things I really love is that, you know, West Auckland, to me, it has the feel of a provincial city, really. People know each other. There are great community networks. No one really cares about what car you drive or things like that. It's a really open and accepting place. I love it.
I've had it explained to me that it's the prevailing westerlies, that they drive away people who are after comfort. And I mean, they're slightly crazy.
I think that's really plausible.
Really outdoor people like to stay. So.
Yeah.
And it makes a lot of sense.
Yeah, it does.
Right, so now the Newland electorate, you're facing significant changes this year, aren't you, compared to what it was 2 years ago?
Yeah, the boundary changes have been quite significant. It's a domino effect. A new electorate has gone in down around Flatbush, and so then the change from there pushes all the way up through the electorates between Flatbush and Newland. So, and in particular, our local area, Mount Roskill, is moving over into what was the Newland area, so it's taking most of New Windsor and all of Lynnfield and a bit of Blockhouse Bay as well. So they're all moving into the Mount Roskill electorate. And in return for that, the Newland electorate is picking up all of the Waitakere ranges, all the way up to Waitakere.
So you're getting some of the most beautiful area in the country.
It turns the electorate into the most beautiful electorate in the country.
Full of very passionate Westies who are very good occasionally. Overly passionate, perhaps. But
actually, it's really wonderful to think that the electorate I represent is going to have those fabulous beaches like Piha and Karikari. I mean, they're just beautiful. And then the glory of Whorapu as well. They're marvellous beaches to have.
In terms of diversity, they're two quite different areas, aren't they? I'm aware on the local board that we have one of the most European-dominated parts of Auckland.
Yeah, look, already in the Newland electorate, the further west it went, the whiter it got. In the 2017 from the 2013 census, at that time the electorate was made up of something like 50% Pākehā, 17% Indian or Pakistani, 13% Chinese, 12% Pacifica. So it was quite diverse. I haven't got the data from the latest census yet, but I suspect on the new data that it will be whiter. I think the Pākehā count will have gone up. I had expected, if the boundaries had stayed the same, I would have expected that Pākehā would have fallen below 50% of the electorate. I think now they'll be up over.
Yeah, there's that outstanding statistic that in Newland, something like half of the people were born overseas. It's a real melting pot, isn't it?
Oh, it's incredible. Actually, I love it. You walk into Lynmore and white faces are the minority. And so it's got quite a different feel from lots of other places in the country. And there's a real vibrancy that comes with that, with the different cultures sort of rubbing up against each other and sharing each other's holidays and the like. But it's just different ideas. And I think it really creates a quite a unique atmosphere.
The new area, though, will be quite a challenge to you, won't it? It's relatively middle class and not necessarily labour-friendly, is it? There's quite a strong green emphasis there, too.
Yeah, what we've found in the past, though, if you look at the voting patterns, it's a left vote, and the voting patterns are often, people might party vote green, but they have candidate voted for the Labour Party candidate. I'm hoping they'll still continue to do that. And I actually think there is a strong Labour vote to be had out in the Waitakere ranges as well, partly in terms of the values we actually share. Which is about a decent life for everyone and for looking after our environment. So I think there's plenty of vote there.
And green policies are mainstream Labour Party policies, aren't they? We do pride ourselves on being an environmental party now.
We do. I think we're all green now, with a small g. Obviously, I'm going to have to get out there and work that vote, and I need to get out there and get known. But I don't find that a worrying prospect. I sort of feel as though I can go up there quite proudly as a Labor MP with Labor values, and that people there will be receptive to them.
Yeah, and there's a history there too, isn't there? David Cunliffe and Lyn Pillay championed the Heritage Area Act and got it through, which covers most
all
of the
Waitakere
new
ranges. So we've got good form in that space as a Labor Party, so I think we'll be fine.
Let's move on to other topics. The government infrastructure announcement made this week.
Huge.
It's caused all sorts of, I think it's a bit of a tsunami, isn't it? There's going to be effects rolling out from it for quite a period of time.
Yeah, I mean, there's an obvious economic impact. So the governor of the Reserve Bank had been urging the Minister of Finance to look at what we were doing fiscally and what we could do to support the New Zealand economy. Now, this infrastructure spending is very much part of that. So when you get to be a pointy-headed economist and you go down that route, you say, well, actually, this is a really sensible Keynesian move for supporting the economy. Interest rates are really, really low, so this is actually a good time to borrow for long-term asset building. So I think that's a really sensible thing that the Minister of Finance has done. It'll support local industry. Fantastic, that's jobs. So there's all those sorts of positives around it. Which would come from any infrastructure spending, but then you've got to start looking at the detail of what the spend is going to be on, and that's quite interesting.
And it's good that the fiscal responsibility rules were slightly, shall we say, bent to accommodate the new spend.
Well, I think those fiscal responsibility rules were something we really needed in place for the last election. Interest rates were slightly higher then. They have been falling. And again, the governor of the Reserve Bank has said something very interesting. It was 6 months or so ago, and he said that he feels that interest rates are returning to their long-run normal. So high interest rates are a feature of the time in which you and I grew up. So when we were borrowing money for our first homes and things like that, I recall my husband and I paid 20% interest.
Yeah, mine was 18.
So they were extraordinarily high interest rates. And the high interest rates we experienced in the 80s and 90s are the aberration. So interest rates now falling back down to 2 or 3% is perhaps the new normal. And so it does mean that we can get into that long-term asset building at comparatively cheap finance rates.
And your fiscal analysis of transport projects, for instance, makes a lot more sense because if you've got a lower yearly cost to them, then
you can get them over that investment hurdle. I think also Treasury has had an investment hurdle of about 5 or 6%. That's quite high. So I think the Minister of Finance is asking Treasury to look at the rate it uses on those and to consider what the long-term interest rates are likely to be, which if you listen to the Governor of the Reserve Bank, it's going to be down about around 1%, 2%, 3%. Yeah, but you know, it's really interesting getting involved in a road building program because we, as a party, we're copping criticism from both the left and the right on that. So probably it's not about the right space.
Yeah, should we talk about that? The cycle bay, the clip onto the Harbour Bridge. It's a great project.
Yeah,
and everyone likes it.
Yeah,
and the money for. I was amazed that we still have schools with. Coal burners.
I know. That's down on the South Island. And, I did my first degree down at Otago, which was cold. And I can understand why school buildings need to be heated in the South Island in ways that they don't up in Auckland. They had all these coal burners, which is incredibly unfriendly with respect to the environment. So, you know, that's a great part of that infrastructure spend is getting those coal-fired burners, the way we heat our schools, replaced with much more environmentally sustainable solar and the like. It's brilliant.
Yeah. I suspect with the roading projects, the devil's in the detail. From what I can understand, there's a bit of extra budget there this time, but it's going to be Mill Road, for instance, there'll be a walkway and a cycleway built at the same time.
So there's a bit of a mode shift going on. I think, you know, we have been criticised by some on the extreme environmental left saying, why are we building more roads? Why aren't we just going public transport? But that's a huge shift to push everyone onto public transport at once. The fact is that a lot of our transport in this country is built around individual cars. And that's not going to change quickly. So what we're doing is saying, yes, we actually do need to accommodate these cars, but at the same time we can accommodate cycling and walking and those other modes of transport. And I think the other thing about the cars is that, sure, the great majority of our fleet at the moment is petrol-powered, but over time that is going to change, and they'll change into being electric cars, or maybe hydrogen cell-fueled cars, something that's much more environmentally friendly. But we're still going to need roads. Electric cars still need the same roads to drive on that petrol-powered cars drive on. So I'm not seeing that building more roads is unfriendly in itself, or environmentally unfriendly. I think it would be problematic if we weren't doing that mode shift as well at the same time.
And Mill Road, for instance, there will be provision made for high-capacity public transport lanes there.
Right, and that's been incredibly successful, hasn't it? You know, coming over the Harbour Bridge and things like that. I think one of my favourite city councillors, Richard Hills, frequently posts about how quickly he gets over that bridge on the rapid transit bus network. So I'd love to see that being replicated elsewhere.
Yep. And there's a further $4 billion left, isn't there? When
and
can we expect?
Who knows? you'll have to ask the Minister of Finance about that. But, yeah, there's more to come and more infrastructure spending to come. So it'll be interesting to see what that is. Actually, it's interesting, too, looking at some of the roads that are being built. It's things like, that under this package, the Ōtaki to Levin bypass. And that's a road I used to drive frequently, the amount of delay on it is incredible. So you get these great long lines of traffic sort of just going very slowly down the road, and yet there isn't really an alternative route. There is a commuter train, but it doesn't run very regularly. So in terms of transport from where I was living in Palmerston North down to Wellington, the easiest way to do it was by car. Now, if you make that a quick and efficient journey, that's actually it's environmentally friendly.
Can we tease that out a little bit? The government's plan, carbon neutral by 2050, means we probably by 2030 we need to pretty well put a brake on petrol-driven vehicles coming into the fleet.
Yeah.
So by then our network's going to have to look quite a bit different to what it is now, isn't it?
Our roading network.
Our transport networks,
yeah, I think so. Actually, we do have to do a big scale up on how we can get points for charging your electric car. We need to have many, many more of them so that people can get to them. So that's part of the change that needs to come through. We need to scale up the amount of electricity we actually produce. So we need to kind of about double it from where it is now in order to accommodate a vehicle fleet that is primarily electric. Actually, we can do that. There's a whole lot of work going on in terms of wind farms and solar and hydrogen fuel, stuff that is designed to increase the actual amount of energy we produce in the country. I think there's another shift we need to engage in, and it's something I've only been thinking about in the last year or so, and that is instead of regarding our hydro lakes as the basics of our supply, they should be our reserve batteries. We actually need to have a whole lot of renewables from wind and solar. And then when the wind isn't blowing, the sun isn't shining, then the hydro lakes become our reserves. At the moment, we use coal as our reserve.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Can I suggest something to you that we are running out of time, though, aren't we?
We do. We need to move faster.
I was involved at the beginning of the double-tracking electrification of the Western Line.
Right.
And we kicked that off in 2003.
Right.
In 2015, I think. I celebrated when I saw the first electric train drive along there.
Yeah.
But that was 12 years.
Yeah.
And we've got a decade where we've got to make some pretty fundamental changes.
Yeah, I think it's a huge challenge for us. And it's not going to be easy. I think that's the interesting thing about the climate change legislation that we put through last year, the Zero Carbon Act. Was it Zero Carbon? What it does is it imposes a legislative requirement on the government to act. So instead of just government making vague promises, it has actually got some legislative requirements in there. And I think certainly that the Labor government will take those seriously.
So we could need some pretty big new capital projects, though, particularly energy.
We could.
So,
and who knows where that infrastructure spend is going.
So is there the government can have a look at the spend and work out if we can spend more?
Oh, I'm sure it can. That's not the sort of discussion as a backbencher that I get involved in, alas. I mean, I love my job. It's fantastic. It's great being the local MP, but it's really interesting. Ministers get to make the decisions.
Shall we move on and talk about the state of the opposition right now? They're not having a very good week, are they?
I think they were quite shocked by the infrastructure announcement. I'm surprised that they hadn't worked out that it was coming. I think, because it was really clearly signalled last year.
It was announced in December, wasn't it?
That's right. And then suddenly they seemed to have no real response to it when the Minister of Finance made the detailed announcements.
Except to claim that they would do it too, which is normally the worst possible response, isn't it?
That's right, that's right. So, and I thought that pointed to something quite interesting, which is that they don't have any coherent thinking themselves around infrastructure. And they, I think, still regard themselves as being the real government, and they haven't really shifted into being an opposition. They just regard themselves as the people who were cheated out of government. But they might have gotten plenty of votes on election night, but government in this country is not formed by single parties.
Yeah, I could be accused of being biased, but they are very good at the day-to-day churn out of news and social media memes and all those sorts of things. But
yeah,
there's no gravitas there, is there? It's just...
It seems to lack substance. And it's interesting sort of thinking about how many people are on social media anyway and what the reach of those memes are. You and I are both intensely engaged by politics and we live and breathe it. We do it all day, most of the day, and things like that, most of the time. But I suspect that lots and lots of people don't really engage that much. They may not see those memes at all. I don't think they carry nearly as much weight as we might worry about, just because most people maybe only turn into politics maybe at election time.
And most people are stuck in their own bubbles, aren't they?
Yeah,
so
they are.
They don't get any change in views.
That's right. Some people have been running quite scared of what they regard as the social media campaign and saying, we've got to be prepared for it. And I'm going, I think we'll be right. The advice is really straightforward. Don't engage.
Does it say something about New Zealand? Australia, America and the UK, they've had elections where right-wing governments have been elected nominally on their social media performance. In New Zealand, are we a bit immune to that sort of thing?
I don't think we'll be immune to it. I just think we've overstated what the social media effect was. If you look at the Australian election, it was won and lost in Queensland and around a very specific issue, which was the Adani coal mine. It was all about jobs. So there was certainly a lot of social media stuff deployed into that space in Queensland. But that was just one of those things. I also think it was done by an incumbent government rather than by an opposition. So I think that made a difference as well. And it was done by an incumbent government where, I mean, I don't get this, Scott Morrison was apparently quite popular.
Yeah.
I don't think Simon Bridges has the same popularity.
And I guess the other factor is the progressive candidate in each country, for whatever reasons, they all struggled.
Yeah.
Whereas Jacinda's had a hell of a couple of years, hasn't she?
She has. She has. She's done extraordinarily well. But the other thing that I think people really respond to with Jacinda is she is genuine. Sincere. So it's the Jacinda you see on TV or whatever is the real Jacinda. So there's a real authenticity there. And I think the leader of our opposition is struggling to match that. I don't think he will.
No. And certainly attacks on an authentic person always come across as being sort of mean-spirited.
I think she's doing a tremendous job. In fact, she's doing so tremendously well that we sometimes ignore how well some of her ministers are doing as well. So Grant Robertson, I think, is doing a fantastic job in finance. He's the economy's running along really well. It's not steaming hot, but you don't want it steaming hot. You just want it ticking over nicely.
No, when you think of the doom and gloom that's come out of the business sector too, it is doing remarkably well.
Yeah, we're actually growing at about 2.4% or something like that. That's pretty good.
Compared to overseas countries.
That's right. Yeah. But again, growth is not everything. You and I know that, rampant growth is appalling for the environment.
Yeah.
So we've got to have a bit of moderation about that. I think, and of course, that will take a hit over the next few months because of the coronavirus in China. But that will be common to economies all over the world.
Yeah. And Bridges ruling out New Zealand first as a National Party coalition partner.
Well, just means he's going to be fighting a war of attrition on two sides, doesn't it? And look where you end up in that.
Yeah.
I'm astonished that he did that. He's, in effect, I think, declaring outright war on New Zealand first, saying he doesn't want them in the parliament at all.
It does seem to attack the whole ethos of MMP too, where the people deliver the government with the makeup, and the parliament has got to make that work.
Yeah. I've found it really interesting in the last couple of years in parliament, because I see the parliament reflecting something I've often said on the doorstep. So I'll knock someone on the doorstep and say I'm there for the Labour Party, and they say, well, I vote National. So my response is always say, well, politics is a conversation. And it is. You actually want that back and forth of ideas, and you certainly don't get a good conversation if it's just all one way. So you do want that opposition in there. And what I see happening in our parliament is an ongoing conversation that's happening every day about within the government about what we should be doing. And what that does is it means that, sure, it's not quick and easy the way you can do it with, a single party controlling the parliament, but we keep on testing our ideas against each other and testing our policies. And any policy that is rolled out, has to have gone through a pretty rigorous process because it's been debated between three parties. And I think that makes for much, much better government. And Bridges is just rejecting that.
I guess the Zero Carbon Act is a good example of that, where oppositional buy-in was achieved and it went through a number of iterations, didn't it, before?
Yeah. Actually, that's a really interesting example because James Shaw and David Parker worked with the opposition on that one, and they worked with the three parties in the coalition government as well to get a mix that would kind of be good enough. So it might not be perfect, but it is certainly good enough, and it got it over the line. And mind you, after it was passed, there was a whole lot of people around praising Simon Bridges for his wise leadership. And I thought, well, that was a nonsense. I think the thing that finally got the National Party over the line was 170,000 people marching in the streets and saying, actually, this is serious.
Yeah. Get on with it.
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah, this year we've got the year of the referenda, haven't we? I'm aware that we've got the end of life.
Sorry, I say referendums.
Oh, I do.
Yeah, just to
be. Loving my law school training.
Yeah.
So the end of life bill, that was a difficult bill for you to get around, wasn't it? And I understand the reasons because for myself also it's not such an easy thing to decide on.
It's really interesting because I, if I just take it in a very purist sense, I do value people's autonomy and their capacity to make decisions for themselves and to have some control over their own lives. I don't see why that shouldn't extend to their own deaths too. But then I sort of worry about people whose autonomy is impaired because they are vulnerable, and they're vulnerable because they have physical disabilities, or they're vulnerable because they're elderly. And I felt as though the bill didn't build in sufficient protections. But the thing that finally swayed me on the end-of-life choices to vote against it was a person writing on disability and living with a disability on Newsroom or on the spin-off or something like that. And he said that he felt, as a disabled person, that he was lived less of a full life than other people in New Zealand, that we didn't pay sufficient attention to the rights of disabled people and that their quality of lives was a lot lower, and that until we ensured that people with disabilities had an equal quality of life, then it was wrong to be going down the route that said that we should go down the route of voluntary euthanasia. Mm. And that was what finally tipped me over to saying, actually, I cannot support this bill.
Yeah. And the good thing is that the debate about the bill was relatively civilised, wasn't it? With a couple of exceptions, perhaps. But
yeah, I thought it was certainly heartfelt. Some members of Parliament expressed views that I found very odd, or things that I just don't agree with at all. But everyone was listened to very quietly and respectfully. No interjections or anything like that in the House. But everyone just listened.
Yeah. And the medicinal cannabis bill, any thoughts on that?
Medicinal cannabis is really straightforward for me. I'll be voting pro that bill. Of course, particularly medicinal cannabis. Recreational cannabis, that's tricky. So that's the one where we're going to have a bill drafted, and the referendum question will ask whether we should be putting that bill through the House. And the objective is to... is it to decriminalise or legalise? You're a lawyer, you know the distinction between those things.
Roughly means about the same thing, actually.
Roughly it does, yeah. And so should we be decriminalising marijuana use and going further and regulating the use of it? I think on the whole, yes, but in this case, my vote will only count as much as anyone else's. My reasons for that are probably to do with reducing harm.
Yeah. There does seem to be a worldwide movement towards liberalisation, doesn't there, of not only cannabis but other drugs as well.
Yeah.
Treating them as health issues rather than criminal issues.
I certainly want to be treated as a health issue. I have huge worries about methamphetamine, or P, which seems to decimate communities. And that worries me terribly. Some of the so-called synthetic cannabis, I wish they didn't call it synthetic cannabis, it's just synthetic drugs, and some of them seem very risky to me. On the other hand, I'd rather see them tested. Yeah.
Yeah, there's one particular variant out west called the zombie drug, which is just appalling.
Right.
I think there's a compelling argument for the natural stuff to be legal and the stuff still to be criminalised. So.
Yeah. I'd be happy enough with that. I guess the other thing is if we can regulate marijuana, then we can have a look at the strength and how strong it is and who's buying it and in what conditions. My big concerns around marijuana are similar to my concerns around alcohol, is that we know that with marijuana, most people can use a bit, no worries, but some people seem to be quite badly affected by it. So we've got to have the protection measures in for them.
Yeah. Yeah, we're coming up to the last couple of minutes, so a few more questions. What have been the highlights for the last couple of years for you?
quite a few. Look, something I'm really enjoying at the moment is I'm working on the arms legislation bill, which is in front of the Finance and Expenditure Select Committee, and that's where we're trying to get in better laws around the ownership of firearms in this country. And that to me feels like a good day at work, you know, doing something that's worth doing. So that to me has been a highlight, doing something, working on that at the moment. So back down in Wellington this week for the final stages of that, going through my select committee. That's a real highlight, just because it's such satisfying work. But the other stuff that I've really enjoyed is the personal stuff and the electorate, so helping individuals with casework or with... And the one that really sticks in my mind is, do you remember the Indian students who took refuge in a church?
Downtown. Yeah,
that's right. And as it turned out, the ombudsman eventually found that there was something wrong with the processing of cases for four of those students. And an advocate for those students lives in my electorate, and so she came to me and said, would I help with that? So we were able to advocate for those students and enable them to get work visas for a year, which is what they wanted. Well, a bit of help for people who needed it. Yeah.
And unfinished business?
Oh, plenty. obviously, I have personal ambitions, but I'd like us to do some more substantial work around tax. I think we can make our system fairer.
Oh, well, I hope that after the election that you will be given the opportunity to do that, Deborah.
That would be fun.
Yeah. So I think we're just about finishing our time now. Nō reira, tēnā koto, tēnā koto, tēnā koto kato.
Get together next week at 9:05 a.m. or listen online anytime on planetaudio.org.nz/redalertradio.